newly hired programmers are particularly likely to be given maintenance work to do. Okay. So I want you to understand what re-engineering is. I want you to understand what reverse engineering is. I want you to understand that there are some question marks about reverse engineering. But I think before we go looking at the slides, I'll show you the kind of thing we're talking about. Oh, come on. Okay, here we go. Here's a little program in Java. And you see it's got a big comment at the top saying what it's called, who wrote it, what it's for. Find the smallest triangular number with more than 500 factors. Why this was interesting, I can't remember. It was some sort of exercise somewhere. And then there's the date that it was revised. And then we've got a class with a public, with a main method, and we've got some internal comments, and we've got variables mostly with single letter names. Now, when you compile it, it turns into this. And I think you'll agree that there are some things you can see in there and there are some things you can't. For example, we can see mention of a string. We can find something called line number table and something called stack map table. We can find the name of the source file. We can find string builder mentioned. We can find object mentioned. We can find system and print stream and string builder, and a bunch of other things, but, I mean, yeah. Okay. One of the tools that comes as a standard part of the Java development kit is a program called Java P. And is it installed on this machine? Yes, it is. It says the Java class file disassembler. What is a disassembler? It is a program that takes a binary file and turns it back into some sort of plain text, ideally in fact, it would be something you could reassemble, so you could disassemble something, you could edit the result and reassemble it. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of options, this is a typical example here of what you get by running the program with the default options. It tells you what the source file name is, well, we saw where that was. It tells you the name of the class and so on, and it tells you the fields and public methods. Well, here's what we get from trist.class. View. Okay. So it doesn't take a huge amount of experience with Java. There is a book about the Java virtual machine instructions. So that's storing one into a variable, load constant 1, store it into variable number 1, load variable number 1, push the immediate value 30,000, compare those things, and if the first is greater than the second, go to opcode at address 250.129, I think it is, and so it goes. This is a bit tedious, but there are assemblers for this, and all sorts of things you can do. Okay, this is, and of course it's annotating here. It says, for example, invoke virtual sharp five. What's sharp five? It's constructing a string builder. And that tells me something rather interesting. When I had system.out.println number plus string plus number plus string plus five calls, one to print a number, one to print a string, one to print a number, one to print a string, one to print a number, you wouldn't bother concatenating that string only to throw away that string. But we look here and we see string builder. Oh my golly, it is actually literally building that string. The Java compiler hasn't the faintest idea what system.out.print does, or system.out.println, rather. Okay? So we've actually learned something from this. But this is human readable. It is human editable with a certain amount of pain. In fact, for Java, we can go further. There is a program which I've got on my desktop and my laptop machines called JD for Java Decompiler. And it's what does a decompiler do? It takes the binary file and turns it back into source code in a human-oriented programming language. So JD takes a java.class file and it unscrambles the egg. So here's what we get from tris.jd. We get this. Now, I've actually changed it by hand. When it does this, it puts the line numbers. It's actually recovered the original line numbers as well. So this is actual human-readable Java source code. We notice two things have disappeared. The comments have disappeared. Java does not save comments in the class file. There's no reason why it couldn't. It just happens not to. Second, it didn't save the variable names. It saved the field names. We can't see that. It saved the method names, but it didn't save the variable names. So, for example, this was called args. This one, I think, this one was called n. I don't really see any point in having, it's used in a hex constant there because it's a bit twiddling operation, but the comment about what the, okay, so this is, I think you'll agree, a lot easier to read than the assembly code, which in turn is a lot easier to read than the binary. So here's the thing about Java. If you give somebody a java.class file or a jar file containing a whole bunch of .class files, you think you have protected your intellectual property by not giving them the source code. You're wrong. They can't get exactly what the source code was. They can't get the comments, but they can get source code that they could recompile to recreate the class file and that they can edit, change, and use. So, for example, there is a Sudoku program that I have, again, on both of these machines, both the laptop and the desktop. And from time to time, it crashes. And I thought, I wonder why. Oh, I've got this decompiler. Why don't I find out? Well, what I discovered is that what should be an extremely simple program has a totally ridiculous number of classes. It's amazingly huge. And it's, frankly, would be less effort to write my own program than to fix theirs. So they've satisfied things through obscurity. Of course, that's why they're bugs. But so this is what I've done here, is I've taken a program. I compiled it this afternoon. I had these files, I've got them on a memory stick somewhere, but I've lost the memory stick, so I had to recreate them. So I compiled it, and then I disassembled it, and then I decompiled it. And decompiling was simply a matter of saying, change to this directory, open the GUI, JD GUI app, and ba-ding, there's the code. And that's fine because it's my code. So, there's a whole bunch of references. An important one here is the Copyright Act 1994, which is the New Zealand law that governs reverse engineering. Okay, we actually have a law that covers this. Now, by the way, I don't think this anecdote is in the notes. There is a notes document for this. I used to work at this company in California, and we had an implementation of a programming language called Prolog, which is a great deal of fun, and it was a very nice implementation, and it was pleasantly fast, given that it compiled to an imaginary machine, just like Java compiles to the JVM, which doesn't actually exist anymore. But we compiled to an imaginary machine called WAM, the Warren Abstract Machine, and one of the people who worked at the company before he joined us had actually published a paper in which he proved that it was impossible for a system built this way to go as fast as it turned out our system did. so we had some very interesting tricks up our sleeves. Well, actually, David H.D. Warren had invented these tricks. And so we were able to actually go quite fast given the approach that we'd taken. After I'd been working there a couple of years, there was a conference coming up, and we were sent some papers for review because, hey, we were experts in this area. And one of these papers described techniques for implementing the WAM, and it came from one of our competitors. Now, these people weren't actually using the Warren Abstract Machine. They had their own approach. Why are they even interested in this? Hang on a minute, didn't we give these people a free 30-day evaluation copy of our software? Where the contract says, thou shalt not disassemble? The only place, there was no other system in existence, including theirs, that used any of the techniques they described, let alone all of them. So we wrote a stiff letter to the conference saying, you know, these people are acting in a highly unethical way. This paper should on no account be published. This is not their ideas. Interface Computer GmbH, German company. They didn't know. BIM, B-I-M, Belgian something something. Interface also did something highly unethical. They plagiarized large chunks of code. Okay. But so the thing is, when you've got a company in Belgium and a company in California, there's a whole lot of expensive lawyer time deciding whose laws apply. And this was in the 1980s, so in New Zealand we now have a law about this, and it's really worth reading this. There's a bunch of links here. You'll find stuff about reverse engineering and re-engineering. And so what I'm going to talk about is, first of all, I'm going to say topicality. Why is this something you need to know now? Is this kind of thing still going on? Then what's reverse engineering and what's re-engineering? We'll talk about that probably on Friday. Now, topicality. There is a programming language called Erlang. Do you remember me showing you this little concurrent program? And I said there's 450 lines of C. There's 86 lines of Erlang. Erlang is now about 30 years old, I think, and it's implemented in a way that's conventional for high-level languages. Python does the same thing. Okay? You've got part of the system is implemented in the language itself, and part of it is implemented in a lower-level language. And for Erlang, the languages are Erlang and C, the Erlang compiler, is written in Erlang. It compiles to an abstract machine. The abstract machine is emulated in C. Plus, there are interfaces to all sorts of things. Now, when it comes to programming languages, C and C++ have a number of rivals that try to give you the same kind of close-to-the-metal performance that C and C++ can, though don't always, but they also try to give you a great deal more safety. There was one that I was really looking forward to using called BitC, which was designed for writing operating systems, and that was a really nice language. The lead investigator got hired by Microsoft, and BitC bit rotted. There's, from a company called Digital Mars, there's a language called D, which is in many ways a very nice language indeed. I don't know how to pronounce this. I don't know whether you call it Rust or Roost. I tend to say Roost just to be safe. And it's trying to give you something that works at the same sort of semantic level as C, but with memory safety guaranteed by the compiler. What do I mean by memory safety? Well, one of the things that... Yeah, Andrew talked about this in the first semester. Andrew was very keen that you should know. What is a buffer overrun? What's the difference between unallocated memory and uninitialized memory? What happens if you try to use a pointer before you've allocated it? What happens if you try to use a pointer after you've freed it? What happens if you allocate a pointer and then allocate it again without freeing the old one? All that kind of stuff. These are memory management errors. For C, there is a program called SPLint. And I might as well... Lint. Did I already talk about this? SPLint, www.sblint.org. The original developer of this has gone on to do other things, but there is a mailing list, and it is getting a bit of maintenance. Security vulnerability, coding mistakes, and one of the things it does, if you give it a little bit of a hand with some annotations, it will check, it is capable of checking statically that every pointer that you use has been allocated and that everything that is allocated is freed. And the first version of SPLint didn't do that. And it used a garbage collector, just like Java and Python do, to make sure that memory was cleaned up. And then the author added this memory checking feature and found it reliable enough to stop using garbage collection and rely on checked manual allocation. Okay, so I use this a lot. Rust is a different language. Rust programming language. This is something you might possibly want to look into yourselves. Okay, so here we've got something that looks a bit... Okay, it's a Hello World program in Rust. it looks a little bit like C and a little bit not like C. And, of course, it's got Unicode built in. But it has guaranteed memory safety, guaranteed threads, multi-concurrent programming, no data races. It's got generic types. It's got pattern matching. This is technically pattern matching. It's got type inference. You don't have to write all the types yourself. It can figure them out. So, for example, you see here greetings. This thing is an array of strings, but you didn't say that. It's initialized to an array of strings. What else could it be? And here, num and greeting are not... The types aren't given, but they come from the iterator over that thing, so what else could they be but an integer and a string? That's type inference. So that's Rust. And starting about a week ago, somebody said, hey, you know, why don't we rewrite the Erlang bottom level in Rust? Okay. We might should be able to get the same speed, and we get memory safety, and we get freedom from data erasers in the low-level code. Would this be a good thing? Why not? Why not? Okay, so let's just try to have a little bit of interaction here. This would be re-engineering. We're taking something that already exists and we're doing it again differently. So why would that be a good idea and why would it be a bad idea? This is the kind of thing I like to ask in exams. Tell me why it's good, tell me why it's bad.
Is the current implementation broken at all?
That is one reason. All human institutions, including computer programs, are semper reformanda, always in need of reform. Every large program is broken. Remember what I said about complex systems. Complex systems always operate in failure mode. It's just that sometimes it shows up and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah, there are bugs in the runtime. After about 30 years, I think most of them have been found. New code occasionally has issues, but the old code is pretty solid. So what this is, it's not a black and white issue. Okay? The question is not, is it broken? Because it is, everything is. It's a question of how badly is it broken? And what is the cost of trying to do something about it? Now, one reason that I mentioned SPLint is that if you want compile time guarantees about memory management, doing it by using C with the annotations for SPLint is another approach. It's the third way. You could use unadorned C, you could use a different programming language, or you could use C with annotations and a checker. Now, I think it's reasonably clear that adding annotations and a checker does one very important thing for you. And that is you do not change the existing working code. You just add comments. So that adding existing annotations adding annotations to the existing code has the benefit that it would not, could not, break anything. We could guarantee this. We can actually put the code through a program that strips out comments and pretty prints it, and then we could compare the code before and after adding the annotations, and if there's any difference, we throw the annotated thing away and start again. Okay, we could make certain that we have done nothing to change what the program does. And then if we find a bug, then we can change it. Okay. But not before. So this would, at all stages, while adding annotations, we would have a working program. If you rewrite something, there's this long period of time when you're putting the labor into the new version, but you can't use it yet. Because this is one of the things that we've talked about before, that nobody ever made, in fact, I think even Jordan Peterson says this somewhere, nobody ever made a successful large system. Not without hugely overrunning budgets of time and money. Successful large systems come from successful small systems that grew. So Erlang has at least tripled in size while I've been watching it, in terms of what's there in the implementation. Most of it's in Erlang. Some of it's tooling around it. So you really want to keep the thing going. But if you're given that you've got people with only a finite amount of time available, if they're working on the new system, they're not fixing bugs in the old one. And of course, type checking and memory management can only take you so far. let's go back to this thing. Suppose I had I there instead of J. The program would still type check. There would be no memory errors. A static checker would see nothing to complain about, but the program would be wrong. So Rust, or Rust, how you pronounce it, can prevent some errors, but it can't prevent all of them. So just rewriting the thing from C to Rust, or Rust, would not guarantee an absence of errors. It would guarantee that certain errors were not there. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the trade-offs are different when you're building new software. If you're building new software, then you've got to grow it from nothing anyway. You're not worried about maintaining an existing program. But if you are building a new program, then it makes sense to say, well, okay, what's going to give me the best trade-off? And if you're writing new software, then saying, well, like, will I do it in C? Will I do it in C++? Will I do it in Rust? I would certainly much rather use Rust than C++. With C++, I've still got to do the manual memory management, but I don't have any guarantees about it. So I think Rust is a better bet for me there. There's another issue too. Erlang runs on everything from Raspberry Pi to great big servers. It runs on Solaris, BSD, Linux, and also under Windows. Now, there are machines out there that have C and could support Erlang, but for which Rust doesn't yet work. So actually building the thing in Rust would cost us portability. So it's an economic trade-off. What is the lost value of portability? What is the gained value from reducing the bug count? And, you know, actually in practice, Erlang is pretty darn robust. I've had more problems with C compilers than I've had with Erlang. Just today, I tried to compile something on a certain machine and it couldn't find a header file, so I couldn't compile anything. Okay. No, Rust wouldn't have helped with that. Okay, so one of the things about software engineering, then, we've always got these trade-offs. We've got to say, what is it good? How does it help? How does it make things worse? What are the costs? What are the benefits? And quite seriously, it would be useful to have a new, clean implementation of Erlang starting from scratch without backwards compatibility issues, but it's the wrong way to do it. Okay, the inventor of Erlang said, well, what we need to do, if you want to do something like this, we need to start by using less C. We need to put more things into Erlang and less in C so that the rewrite is a smaller effort. Okay, now the New Zealand Copyright Act, 1994. I might as well actually open this up. Is this going to work? No, it's not actually, because the document's on a different machine. Okay. Making a backup copy of software, it's guaranteed okay. And contractual terms trying to stop you doing something illegal have no effect. If somebody says, I will sell you this program, okay, you've given me your money. Now, the contract that I've imposed on you says you cannot make a backup of this. You can say, no, 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 no. The government says I can. So there. Okay. The idea here is a very simple point of justice. You've paid money to get the use of something. You're entitled to take reasonable precautions to be able to continue that use. Decompilation is okay if you need to make something else talk to that program. So suppose you've got a program that needs to generate something that Microsoft Word can read. Okay. You're not planning to change Word itself. You're not making to build a rival to Word. You just want to make something that writes data that Word can read. And you find that the existing documentation on that format isn't clear enough. It's okay to poke around in the guts of Word to get the information you need if you can't get it reasonably from some other source. Making a copy of something in order to fix it is okay if that's your only practical alternative. So if a properly function and error-free copy of the program is not available, I think a court would probably interpret that as free of the error that you are trying to correct, because there is no such thing as an error-free program, right? Not available within a reasonable time at an ordinary commercial price. So if you report, if you're a hospital, say, and you report to Megahard, an imaginary company, we can't register patients because your health system isn't working. There's this bug. It rejects all names that don't contain a mandala character, something like that. And they say, well, we'll fix that, but we've got it on the list and we're going to do it in 5 years' time. Or if you're willing to pay us another $1 million, we'll do it now. In that case, you're entitled to make a copy of their software, poke around inside it, figure out the problem for yourself, and fix it for yourself, whatever their contract says. Watching what a program's doing is okay if you're doing something else at the same time that's legal. Okay. So, for example, on a Macintosh, how many of you played with Activity Monitor? I need another window. Open-A Activity Monitor. Okay. Now, this tells us about all the running programs. And, for example, here's Firefox. And let me just double-check. This one, I can say, give me information about it. It says, okay. So that's how much memory it's using. It's got, good grief, Firefox has 62 threads running. I wonder why. It's a very busy little program indeed. And we can find out what files it's got open. Okay. Not only that, I can do this. Okay, I've waited, there we go. And what it's done, it's sampled the program for 3 seconds, sampled it every millisecond. And it's saying, look, hey, this is what I saw on the stack. I'm finding out something, like, so for example, by looking at this, I can say, oh yes, that's part of Objective-C, that's how you do an application, a GUI application. So, and it's in the event loop, and this is what it's doing here, and this is what it's doing here, and I can start poking around in here to find out what this is doing. Now, I'm doing this safely because actually I am using Firefox for a legal purpose while I'm observing what's happening. Also, it's an open source project anyway. I find Activity Monitor a very, very handy little tool. So, for example, on a laptop, which program is burning up the most energy? And, of course, surprise, surprise, at the moment it's Firefox. Okay, so there are these conditions under which it is okay to poke around inside a program that maybe somebody else used, wrote, and owns, but as long as you've got it for a legal purpose, you've got the legal right to use this thing, you can do whatever you need to do within reason to keep on using it. But you've got to be a lawful user of the program. And you're studying it only while performing acts that you're otherwise entitled to do. So I was able to study Firefox while running it. That's okay. because I'm allowed to use Firefox. Decompilation to develop something that works the same way is explicitly forbidden, and decompilation is forbidden if you could learn what you need some other way. So if there is a document that describes the key data structures clearly, You go to publicly available sources, resources first. This is one thing to negotiate. By the way, one important case where a repaired version isn't going to be available in a reasonable time is when the company's gone bust. So if you need to keep a program running, then the company that made it has gone out of business, again, you're entitled to do whatever you have to within reason to keep it going. The law doesn't always allow what's right, and the law sometimes does allow what's wrong. So,
Richard.
Yep.
For example, like if a company had sold this product to people, it went bust.
Yep.
Another company wouldn't be allowed to like whilst individual users would be allowed to like maintain it, right? Another company couldn't pick it up, copy it, and start maintaining and selling their product.
They would have to buy the rights from the receiver. Now, I mean, this is one thing that people have been talking about for years. They've been saying that there ought to be a requirement that abandonware becomes public domain. That if nobody is maintaining a program, then its source code should be opened up to the public. One of my pet peeves is, there's a particular system I would love to use, and there's a company... a one-man company, basically, that bought the rights, and they're basically squatting on it. They're not doing any maintenance, and they're charging huge amounts for it because, basically, people who have critical software written that way are willing to pay a large amount. So one important thing here is that laws are different in different countries and at different times. So you need to read licenses and things very carefully. For example, a lot of the American software contracts say something like this: in the case of a dispute, the laws of the state of Delaware shall apply. Why the laws of the state of Delaware? Because it's particularly friendly to business. So you have to figure out which laws apply. But for ordinary purposes, you should be okay. And one thing here is the ACM Code of Ethics says be careful to use only accurate data derived by ethical and lawful means. So you've got to do things that the law allows and good morality allows. And to use it only in ways properly authorised. So reverse engineering is sometimes something, you know, poking around an existing system somehow. Sometimes we've just got to do it. But there are conditions under which that is okay. And so the point about this slide is if you find yourselves in a situation where reverse engineering software from somebody else seems like a good idea, you will need, or your company will need, to check what is the legal situation then. I can tell you what it was according to the 1994 Act. There might well have been a revision since then. I don't know. Maybe I should look it up. So here's where it all sorts of fits in. The forward engineering thing, the waterfall approach, is gather your requirements, produce a specification. The requirements are designed for talking to the customer. The specification is designed for talking to the programmers and the test generators. And then you write the documentation, and you write the test cases, and then you write the code, and then you test everything, and then you deliver it, and you heave a sigh of relief, and you go back. And you dive into your money bin and count your profits. Ha, 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 ha. Practically no game developers make serious money from their games, by the way. Almost no people who write games for iPhones and so on make a living wage from it. It's something that's very hard to make money for. The Bohm spiral model, and again, you should check previous year's exams. I do like to reuse exam questions quite a lot. I change them around a little bit, but not that hugely. Basically turns this into a series of psyche goes spiralling around in this, but it involves some of the same activities. Now, the thing about re-engineering, each of the stages above builds on the products from the previous stages and bubble from the documents, okay? I'll give you an example here. Quintus Prologue was a descendant of Deck 10 Prologue. And Deck 10 Prologue had two compilers, the old compiler and the new compiler. And the new compiler was compiled using the old compiler. You couldn't compile the new compiler without the old compiler, right? But there was a problem. The sources of the old compiler had been completely lost. Now, if ever there was a case for reverse engineering, that was it. The design of the previous compiler, of the old compiler, had been published. It would have been less work to build a new compiler from the published explanation of how the compiler worked. Probably it would have been easier still to make the new compiler self-hosting. Nobody ever bothered because it was quite clear that machines with an 18-bit address space, which admittedly is words, so it's the equivalent of a 20-bit address space. This was a mainframe, but each process had about as much memory available to it as on the original IBM PC. This is silly. It was clear that the future was much bigger address spaces, so that a whole new implementation was going to be needed anyway. So in that case, it just made sense to say, okay, here's the binaries, cherish them because we can't build new ones. I mean, this seems like an extraordinary thing to happen, but it did actually happen. But it was not necessarily fatal, because the documentation that said how it worked, you know, what the various constructs that it accepted in the source language, what they were, what they meant, and how it worked, and what kind of code it generated, those things were all documented, and we had the guy who wrote it. So we could have built a new one from that knowledge base. This is why people talk about intellectual property. It's not the code as such that's so valuable, it's the knowledge that's behind it. So sometimes you lose the documentation. And so, for example, there was somebody earlier this year wanted to use a program, some sort of psychology program, I've forgotten the details. And their problem was, it was, they had binaries for MS-DOS. And Windows these days does not come with the ability to, I mean, Windows used to be able to run MS-DOS programs, these days it doesn't. Well, fortunately, there is a free program called DOSBox that lets you emulate MS-DOS under Unix. But you know, there were things like, what is the file format that this thing's working with? How do we figure that out? And, you know, it had to be figured out. We had to figure out the specification for the file format by looking at sample files. Okay, so re-engineering is where you go back a few steps and then work forward again. So you say, well, we're not going to fix this compiler. We're going to start from the documentation and build a new one. This is what was being proposed for Erlang, to say, well, okay, we've got this thing, it's documented. Let's start from the specification and work forwards again, producing an independent code base. If some of the key documents are missing, you've got to reconstruct that documentation before you can get anywhere else. So reverse engineering is reconstructing missing design documents or cleaning up the original ones so that when you might make the re-engineering changes. So reverse engineering, you're going back in development time, trying to reconstruct the documentation that should have been there but wasn't. And then re-engineering is when you move forward. and it's now 10 to 5 according to the clock, so I should let you back. But I've shown you, for example, here one kind of this, but normally, in fact, the documentation is actually much more important. Okay, let me give you one example here. There's a system that I would like to reconstruct, a historic programming language, that at the time I didn't like it much, but with hindsight it's actually pretty neat. I'd like to reconstruct it. The existing documentation, it was published in a book, but then there are samples of the actual code and they don't quite match the book. Okay, before I can rebuild a new version, I have to reconstruct the documentation. I have to fill out all of the details that were left unsaid. Now, I can't actually guarantee to make them exactly match what the old system did because I don't have an old system to try out. In fact, one of the reasons for trying to do this is that this system, all existing copies of the documentation were destroyed in a fire. So all existing copies of the complete documentation were destroyed in a fire. So I'd like to rebuild it, and I have to start by reconstructing the specification. The slides and the notes are on the web. They're not linked yet. I will fix the link tonight or tomorrow. And there's another example.